Exactly. We've always avoided clickbait. You know, even within an interview, if someone says something dicey or controversial or eye-opening, we never promote that, you know, because we always, like Elton, you know, our other partner, he always says his cornerstone of every article we put out is, what's the reader going to learn as a bass player from this? What are they going to take from this and pick up their bass and be a better bass player for?
Welcome to episode 96 of the Bass Shed podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, so as I mentioned, I did a photo shoot a few weeks ago for my album. The album is titled Smile, after the Charlie Chaplin tune. The album is a total of 8 tracks, and 7 of those are tunes. 7 are actually instrumentals. The 8th track is a narration of the lyrics to the song Smile. The lyrics were written by John Turner and Jeffrey Parsons. I was in the studio earlier this week, actually, working on the mix, and I'm pretty stoked about the shape the record is taking. I did the photo shoot, and the photographer is Genevieve Lauren. She did a fantastic job. There's some shots from one of the recording sessions. Then we did some location shots. She was absolutely great. She was great to work with. And so a huge shout out to Genevieve Lauren. Now, the problem with getting pictures done is looking back at them. not because of the composition of the photo, but because they're pictures of me, right? So, you know, like, it's always a thing when you have to look at yourself too much. It's a little bit of a problem. So that's kind of the latest update. Working on the mix, and Ryan is disgusted with himself. So there you go. Good times. Some news about the Bass Shed Academy. I started the webpage for it. That is www.com. I don't know if I still need to do the www, right? I feel like we've all spent a little bit of time on the internet. We all know about the www, huh? The webpage for it is at thebassshed.com/academy. There's some information about myself and the 2 other instructors that will be joining me to round out the faculty. Again, the launch party for the academy is January 7th at Lemur Music. There's information on the webpage about all of that. I know I've said it before, but it has been an honor to be partnering with Lemur Music for the Bass Shed Academy. Make sure to stop by lemurmusic.com for everything you need for the double bass. Check out their inventory and use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off everything that they offer. lemurmusic.com. All right, on the episode is John DiOria and Chris GC. John DiOria is the editor-in-chief of Bass Magazine, and Chris GC is the senior editor of Bass Magazine. For some younger cats, here's a little backstory. Bass Magazine is the folks from the old Bass Player Magazine. Bass Player Magazine, back in the day, was the touchstone. That's where all bass players kind of had to go to check in on the latest news about what was happening within the bass world, throughout the bass community. Like, Bass Player Magazine was it. That was kind of like the standard publication. There were other magazines. There's some out of the UK. And those were cool. I'm not knocking those magazines by any means. But I feel like at least here, and at least for me, in the States, and for me, Bass Player Magazine was absolutely the magazine you had to check in with. And so it is an honor to be speaking with the folks from Bass Magazine, which is still the ethos, the ethos, and a lot of the folks, a lot of the contributors and editors of the old Bass Player Magazine. All right, here's a little backstory on John. John started playing the bass in 2000. He quickly became obsessed and immersed himself in the playing of his heroes and the history of the instrument. John landed his first writing gig with the help of Ed Friedland and Elton Bradman, and he became a contributing writer and the online editor to Guitar World's Bass Guitar Magazine. John went on to write, edit, and photograph for Bass Guitar Magazine, Premier Guitar, iBass, Guitar World, and several others. John DiOria has been an editor, writer, and photographer in bass journalism since 2006. Upon the buyout of Bass Player Magazine, he became one of the founding members of Bass Magazine. All right, so here's a little bit about Chris GC. And what I love about Chris is the OG. Chris has covered so many bass players from so many genres and so much information about bass. It's pretty astounding. Chris Gisi is a New York City born and raised professional bassist and music journalist. His recording credits range from Shaggy's 2000 platinum album Hot Shot to the soundtrack of the 2009 hit movie Bride Wars. He continued to write about bass players for Guitar Player, Guitar World, Musician, Drums and Drumming, and other music publications until landing the staff writer position with Bass Player magazine when it started in 1990. Chris spent the next 28 years interviewing the who's who of bassists in all styles and eventually serving as Bass Player's editor-in-chief from 2014 to 2018. Stop by bassmagazine.com to learn more about John DeOria and Chris Gisi, and while you're there, make sure to check out the magazine itself. That's kind of the super important part, is everything that they are still publishing about the world of bass. I will have links up to all of it at thebassshed.com/podcast/bassmagazine. Or you can simply just click on the tab, Bass Magazine, at thebassshed.com. All right, let's just get to it. Here's my talk with John DeOria, the editor-in-chief of Bass Magazine, and Chris Gisi, the senior editor of Bass Magazine.
There we go. What's up, man? How you doing?
Doing good, man. Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you. How have you been?
Doing all right.
What's up, Chris?
Sorry, I hit the dreaded Zoom updates, you know, the thing we
all... It happens to me. Mine does it like every session now, so I'm always like, okay, early, I need to get on.
You need to get on earlier. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
I'm always like 5 minutes late because of those damn updates.
All good. Gentlemen, welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us, man.
Gentlemen, it's fascinating to talk to both of you as someone who does interviews. And you guys have both been in the interview game for a long time. John, you've done over 250 interviews. Chris, you've done over 350. What are some memorable interviews that you guys have done? Because I know for myself, like I remember little kind of Polaroid pictures of probably each guest. But it's difficult to retain all of it, you know?
For sure.
What are some that might stand out to you that were memorable interviews you've had?
I have a good handful. Chris, I always love thinking about and talking about your first interview with Anthony Jackson, which, how long did that last?
11 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Because I didn't even think my mother's labor lasted 11 hours to have me.
Right. Yeah. What was the deal? You went to a gig and then just, it was a full night thing, right?
That was first on my list for interviews. Yeah. So when you interview Anthony, the thing to know is nothing that you expect will be true. You'll think he's into the same bass players as everyone else. That's not true. You have no clue of why, you know, Ryan had never heard of Messiaen, you know, his big influence. It's just the kind of interview where like, wow, this guy's really coming from a different place. So that was a good lesson, because up to then the interviews had been like, oh yeah, we all like Zeppelin and Motown and everything. But
yeah, yeah.
Why do you use a volume pedal? Yeah, you know, it's just completely. Mm-hmm.
And now was that engaging for you as being the interviewer, or was it challenging for you to interview him with all this like kind of information that's coming out of left field?
It probably became more of a hang, right? Like for that long.
Yeah, yeah.
It's intimidating because you're not sure your next question even applies, but then
right,
it taught you to listen because he knew what he wanted to say about every topic. So he's such a great interviewer and such a great writer that it was easy in that way. But I was definitely like, oh boy, change of plans.
abort mission.
We're talking about French organists from the 1800s.
Yeah. See, I wouldn't be able to hang in that conversation. There's no way that could go 11 hours. I got like, you know,
yeah,
20 seconds where I'm just like, what? And then move on.
Yeah.
No, but like a lot of these guys, he wanted to talk, you know, when we came along as bass player, there really hadn't been an outlet.
Right.
I mean, when I first interviewed Rocco, the first time was with Willie and Jeff Berlin. And I could just see on his face, I mean, the joy of finally being recognized. That was the great thing in the early days of bass player.
Yeah.
And he's very, you know, Rocco's gruff, super friendly, but gruff, but very out of character. At one point, he just grabbed me and kissed me for being finally his story being told. And you're running, I run into that a lot on my interviews.
Yeah.
That's cool. Amazing, man. Man, I would say a couple big ones. I mean, I had a cool experience where, like, I'm a huge Tool, you know, and Justin Chancellor fan. And I got to go out to the Warwick base camp a few years, and he was one of the guests. And I was like, I saw him on the list for interviews because there were only a couple of us journalists out there. I was like, there's no way Justin's coming. And sure enough, he showed up, and he showed up when all this stuff was going on. So I just kind of got to hang out with him for a day. And we had an interview scheduled, but his flight was delayed. And he's like, we'll get to the interview, you know, but let's go have a beer, you know, let's hang out, you know, this and this. And so we hung out at the event and all this and that. And then he hit a point, you know, everyone was drinking these big, huge handles of Heffenweisen. And he's like, hey, he's like, I owe you an interview. Like, let's go do it. And I was like, okay. And so we went out and we just start walking, and we end up deep in this forest in the middle of Markneukirchen, Germany. And we just kind of, I'm like laying on a log with Justin Chancellor from Tool, looking at the stars, and just like, we just had such a deep, you know, talk about so many things, I'm sure, that every Tool fan would want to hear. And then you got to spend the rest of the weekend with him, and we get back in town, and he calls and he said, hey, like, let's not run that interview. You know, like it was late at night, you know, and I can't fully, you know, recall it.
Yeah.
Why don't you come out to Tool's studio and let's redo the interview? So I was like, okay.
Dope.
And so I went out, you know, to LA, and I got to spend a day just in Tool's rehearsal, you know, studio where they had written every song as a band. And that was just insane, because it was his rig, all his insane pedal board. And it turned into like karaoke for me, to where I'd be like, hey, show me the outro of Lateralis. Yeah. Okay. And he would just start playing, and I'd be like, hey, play the beginning of The Grudge. And he would just play. And it was like an hour of just,
oh man,
which was so surreal. So that's probably tops on my list. But I think, and also our interview numbers, I think, are much more, especially after the check-ins. You're over 400, Chris, right?
I never counted.
Yeah, because I'm around four. I have all the recordings.
Okay.
Around 400. But Chris has been, you know, Chris is like the original bass journalist. So his doubles mine for sure with that, having been done this. Chris, when was your first like bass interview?
1982. So what if I have done a year? My gosh. Yeah.
82. That's when I was born.
Right.
So not to make you feel old, Chris. Sorry.
Just going to shove that out there.
But I mean, I can easily do the math on it.
Right.
Who was it? Who was your first interview?
I was studying in New York with Lincoln Goines.
Oh, yeah.
I was getting guitar players a subscription for the bass interviews. And when one would show up without a bass interview, all of us bass players would be bummed because they didn't have them every month.
Okay.
And finally, I got frustrated, and I went to the lesson. I said, Lincoln, instead of a lesson, I'm going to interview you and send it into them. They bought it. I couldn't believe it. They need, there was a, you know, they needed bass writers.
So yeah.
They bought it and set me on my path. Yeah, that's how I got started in it.
Nice. What kind of stuff were you playing back then? You were studying with Lincoln, but you were gigging also?
I'm same thing I'm doing now, weddings in New York.
So. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which actually, that's how you and I connected, Chris. Mutual friend, Roy Dunlap, who I think you had played with in New York. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Roy's a dear friend of mine. He's touring with Michael Bublé right now.
That's crazy. Is that a Dublin gig?
No, he's playing piano.
Mm.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah, Eric Curtis is the bass player. Who's that?
His brother is the bass player.
Eric Curtis is the bass player.
Oh, wait, I'm confusing. Okay. I sound like my age on this podcast. Roy Dunlop, the piano player.
Yeah.
That's the crazy thing about the bands that you play in, Chris, is there's always like one degree of separation from everyone.
Right.
You know, like, and
especially
and
there, I'm guessing. Someone. Like, I've never played in New York, but I can assume it's similar to LA, that everybody's so spread out as a musician that you're one degree from everybody.
Right. Mm-hmm. Isn't that way in LA? The people you must see on the wedding gigs you do, you're probably like, oh my God, this guy.
Yeah. That's pretty, they just got off the road with somebody heavier. We're just on TV a couple days ago, and then you're playing at a hill.
Good for him. What a good guy.
Yeah, he's great. He's great.
That's the thing that people don't realize is that, you know, we always talk about this, is the music industry seems like this massive, you know, universe of its own. But I mean, it's such a small world and everybody knows everybody. And it's like, you know, I always say like the music world is like a small house that everyone's in. And the bass world is like a small closet in that house.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
everybody. Yeah,
and you know what he wants to go into.
Hey, we're having a blast in there, but
yeah,
like at our events and stuff and just connections, I feel like there's no bass player that doesn't know like every bass player, you know, and it's kind of a rare, cool community in that sense, to where everyone's putting each other on, you know, you see someone take a different gig, they put someone else on this gig, and you know, it's very rare in the music world that it's not just like butting heads and competition and assholes, you know.
There's a lot of love. Yeah. And I think before I moved to Los Angeles, and definitely before I started getting into this and like understanding how much all the manufacturers, how connected they all are, like one guy used to work over here. And then so it's, I mean, they're all, you know,
that's such a good point.
So connected.
Yeah,
when we've been bass player live all those years, I always marveled at how all the bass players got along from different styles and had respect for each other. Yeah. Like I saw Justin Melville Johnson see Victor Bailey. Oh no, it was the other way around. Victor Bailey saw Justin and said, "Hey, Justin," and I'm like, "That's so great." It intermingles, so I got used to that. But what I never got used to was how these companies all work together, because you knew that they all had different policies on how to make the best amp and the best guitar. Sure. That actually impresses me more than bass players getting along.
For sure.
Right.
Yeah, that's crazy. But like you were saying, it's like, you know, that person at Dunlop was at Ampeg for a while, and before that was at Aguilar. And so it's like, it's so incestuous, like in that sense, to where, but it's great though, because, you know, when we have events and such, everyone's supportive of each other, you know, like the gear companies. Yeah, Chris, you're right. It's really surprising. You would think it would be a fierce competition where everyone's just kind of like, you know, fighting to get to the top. But
I remember being young, reading Bass Player magazine, and you see all the different musicians that are, you know, there's a write up or an interview with, and then you see all the different page layouts for the new gear, and you think it's just all this separate stuff.
Right.
And then once you get in the closet, you realize everybody knows each other. Yes. And the world is so small. The world is so small.
I remember those ads from early Bass Player where they would get their whole roster, you know, Ampeg or Warwick. And you would see, I mean, that was how Victor Wooten and Steve Bailey met. They were just, you know, talking about with us. There was an ad for some kind of amp. And it was, APA. And it was Les Claypool, Steve Bailey, and Victor Wooten. And for the photo shoot, they had all never met. And like Steve Bailey and Victor just clicked. And I remember that ad, though. It's crazy. That's they would amazing. Line them all up. It's very all different.
Right. Who is the bass player ads make? That's the amazing thing.
That was like the social media back then, is like who's on the Harkey and who's on the, you know, Ampeg and the. Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. That was kind of that.
Speaking of that, I mean, that's kind of a good segue. Like, how has a magazine adapted to the social media thing? Because everybody's advertising themselves now, and everybody looks to influencers or whoever these tastemakers are to set the standard within an industry or to get information about an industry, instead of having one, you know, kind of landmark publication that we all visit.
For sure. And that's been an interesting course. You know, I took over as the gear editor of Bass Player a while back, like 2014, maybe. And that was kind of the goal, was to like take it like, you know, we were still printing all that. And it was like, but we have to be relevant in these, you know, fields. Sure. So it was interesting figuring that out. Like, what are people going to like? I can't just post our content constantly because we're still selling issues. So that was interesting to navigate. And you know, people, we always kind of went with, you know, just interesting content, a lot of images of bases and gear. And and memes kind of became the currency of the internet. And we were like, man, we'll dip our toe in it. And then you start getting a ton of likes and you're like, okay, if people are going to like this silly meme about this, you know, are they going to click on our content when we post it? And it's actually transitioned into that, you know. And luckily now with Base Magazine, we have a really large social media following with a lot of engagement and a lot of impressions. And that's kind of our lifeblood. But I'll never forget early on, like players like Ben Kenny of Incubus and Adam Blackstone.
Yeah.
Amazing. You know, MD, they kind of very early on were like cautious. And they said in interviews, they were like, hey, like for bass players and young bass players, like don't be delusional about social media because you're only seeing everyone's best 59 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, and you're not seeing them mess up. You're not seeing a full gig. You're not seeing a full song. Everyone's just tapping and slapping their way to likes, you know, and, you know, so don't let that be your standard. And that's kind of, you know, rung true.
I completely agree with all that. And I mean, I personally, I get dark about it, you know, like I'll scroll through social media and I'm like, okay, cool. Like, do you know tunes?
Yes,
you know,
yes. Like,
exactly. Do you know any rep? You know, like,
yep.
What can you, whatever, like, what are your decisions going to be as a bass player on the gig to, because what your decisions are when you're not playing with anybody are drastically different than what you make to support, you know, a band.
For sure. And that was what we, on our most recent cover story, we had four cats who grew up in the Philly, Jersey area, which was Adam Blackstone, Thaddeus Tribbett, Dwayne Moore, and Derek Hodge.
Yeah.
And they talked about this a lot. And my favorite thing was, I think it was Wayne Moore was like, he's like, I don't want to hear you slap and tap for 60 seconds. He's like, I want to hear you play a whole note. Like, let me see where you place that whole note. I want to see you play a standard where you're just hitting them with the kick. That's right. The, you know, cornerstone of a bass player. And because it's wild, you know, I mean, you go on, if we just pulled up a screen right now on Instagram, it'd be widdly, widdly, slappy, tappy. You know, all that kind of stuff. And one thing I love is the kids that just crush all three of us on bass at a young age that, you know, you have people on there that you have 9, 12-year-olds who just, you know,
demolish. Yeah, they're technically crushing it on the instrument. Yeah, and I'm not going to discredit the time and effort and natural talent that's going on there.
For sure. I thought I would be salty the older I got. With the young generation, but I'm really not. I'm like so inspired by, you know, because they all love Jamerson and they all love Jocko and they all love Carole Kaye. And it's like, you know, it isn't what I was afraid it might be. But yeah, these kids are they take my.
And I know you're passionate about bass history as much as I am. And like really getting with records and understanding everybody's personal style. And, you know, what was it that made Jamerson so killing, you know, or Carole Kaye or all these people, like what was Duck Dunn doing that was different than Jamerson, but it was all soul music. It was all the same time era, you know, like really getting into that. I'm super passionate about that. And it's cool that younger people are interested in those things and not just going for all the flash.
For sure.
So there's that, but more often than not, I do get salty about the thing. Cause it's just like, it's created a whole culture, and that's not what it is.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
But Adam Blackstone drove that point home best of all with his record that we heard after we did the piece. And it's
His record.
It's pretty much him next to an upright bass behind the big band. It's like, what?
Really?
How would you expect?
He's playing standards. Yeah, he's playing standards, and he's playing. And it's just, it's, you would expect this guy who's, you know, you turn on your TV and Adam Blackstone's on your TV.
Name a popular tour and, you know, either Blackstone did the contracting or he's on the gig.
Exactly. Yeah. Like Saturday Night Live should be like Saturday Night Live featuring musical director Adam Blackstone. Like every guest from Nicki Minaj to Megan Thee Stallion to, you know, he's back there on bass musical directing. And, but it's, you know, with the social media, it's interesting because, you know, Chris and Elton Bradman, our other partner in this, you know, have been doing it for so long that they got to see the full transition before social media, you know, before everything.
Before the internet. Yeah.
And so,
Chris, I mean, what was that like? Sorry to interrupt, John, but what was that like?
I remember when it was coming on, because what was the first thing? Was it MySpace?
For social stuff,
And Adam Nitti was one of the first guys. You could tell the guys who recognized it and jumped that way. Yannick, Adam Nitti.
Yeah.
But before that, I don't know. It's such different terrain. We were the one and only source. If you wanted to know anything about a rock star or a studio guy, it was only one way to find. It just blows my mind because now everybody's an open book. Lee Sklar is going on every day and telling me something about it. How do you?
I don't know if it's competition, but how do you sustain a publication when everybody else is beating you to the punch?
Exactly. Just kind of getting it out. And that was the importance of Bass Player in the print era was when I would get that, I would read every article word for word, because like Chris said, that was your only resource for knowing anything about the artist that influenced you and you loved. And so every new issue, I would read five times every word. And I'd be like, oh, like that's what Leonard Hubbard's like, or, oh, that's what, you know, Les Claypool, you know, is thinking about the new Primus album, and it had such magnitude. So that, you know, you bring up a really good point to where, like, what does, you know, like being in the year, you know, 2022, what can you bring? And, you know, what Chris and Eldon and I always say is, like, for us, it's mainly just, you know, the access that we've built up, over
the network is massive.
The network and that, you know, it's crazy, you know, especially Chris is just a Rolodex of, luckily, you know, between Chris Eldon and I, we cover, you know, most every prominent, you know, bass player or company or everything out there. And it's just wild. Like, you know, I'll be watching like, Jimmy Kimmel and I'll be like, you know, Pino was on, what's this bass, you know, Pino was playing, and Chris is like, I'll ask him. And then the next day, like, oh, it was this like vintage, this that he found here, you know? And so, you know, a lot of it is just access and the kind of the trust we've built, you know, over the years to where, you know, players will open up or they know that we're going to present them, you know, very transparently and in a good light.
And that's rare. That's rare within the music business at all is, someone you can kind of trust and go to and always feel comfortable and safe and know that they're respecting you.
For sure.
We're not just trying to get something from you.
Exactly. We've always avoided clickbait, you know, even within an interview, if someone says something dicey or controversial or eye-opening, you know, that even everyone kind of wants them to say like, come on, talk shit, you know, or say this. We never promote that, you know, because we always like Elton, you know, our other partner, he always says his cornerstone of every article we put out is what's the reader going to learn as a bass player from this? What are they going to take from this and pick up their bass and be a better bass player?
Yeah. For? Keeping it inspirational. That's huge.
For sure. And that's kind of always been the principle of it, you know, and so we've morphed our writing, you know, to where even like Chris kind of started introducing like a, when someone puts out an album, let's do a track by track breakdown. Let's have them explain what they're doing on each one so we can kind of get into that. You know, we still do transcriptions and complete transcriptions, lessons. It's hard, like you're saying though, Ryan, like with gear reviews and transcriptions and lessons, it's so saturated now to where if you want to learn how to play a song, it's a beautiful thing because you can go on YouTube and there's the most patient, awesome people who are like, here's the tab and I'm going to play it slowly first. Sure. And then we're going to, you know, and you're in that space, Ryan, you know, and all that. And it's like
a little bit. Yeah. I was just updating my website earlier today, talking about like the backstory of the bass shed and putting that on the website. And, I mean, it started as a transcription website, like, and only because when I got into this thing and it was kind of suggested that I get into online lessons, I had to, and I've been teaching since I was 17. So I'm like, okay, I don't want to teach triads, you know, I don't want to put all this time and effort into, you know, this is the E string, this is the A string,
right?
So I'm like, this is musically fulfilling for me and something I'm interested in putting my time into, and then and doing it on both upright and electric. But the amount of interest, the amount of time it takes, and the payoff for it, it's not worth it. Personally, the payoff is huge,
right?
But kind of doing it just as an online business model failed miserably you know, for transcriptions. One, the amount of people that probably actually read these days is diminished, I'm sure. And two, like maybe there's so much clickbait, and I'm sure you guys run into this regularly, that to sift through the clickbait, you know, people that find me or might be interested in how I conduct interviews or what I have to say in a video, those are the people that will benefit from it, hopefully.
For sure.
But it's not five ways to sound like Pino overnight. Mm-hmm. Like, no, right. Pino didn't sound like Pino overnight. Like,
no, no. You know? Not one bit.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you want to be great, it takes time and effort, and you know, you got to be in it. Mm-hmm. Like both of you guys know, you know, like it's
for sure. It takes.
You got to grind it out.
And that was a big thing with Bass Player early too, Chris, was the tabs and transcriptions were huge. Where, you know, if Rage Against the Machine put on an album and you know, here's Tim Comerford's interview and now learn these three tracks, that's something that's kind of, you know, changed. Cause that again was exclusive to, you know, a magazine print like that. And Chris,
that was the difference. Forever. We weren't somebody who's fully capable and doing the transcription and very accurately, but not knowing the context. Our thing was, we're not doing a transcription to cheat you. We're doing this transcription because we had access to the guy.
Mm. Right.
So I'm not just transcribing. I want you back. I'm talking to Wilton Felder about why he played what he did.
Right. Right.
That's what made that section special to me. Not about a bunch of just transcriptions of what I got to have the context. And the great thing about that, why it's one of my favorite parts of Bass Player, was the stories you get.
Yeah.
Like Jerry Jamont on the BB King record. Live and well. I mean, it's a classic record. Mm-hmm. The backstory was BB was freaked out. He didn't have his band. He's suddenly in a studio with New York session guys and hated it. And somehow the magic came from that. The thrill is gone, that famous version. So yeah, the context is really the key in anything. And it's why I think even we still exist, because sure, there are a lot of bass players promoting themselves and all, but there's still a need for somebody to talk to tell your story.
Yeah.
You can't tell it the same way. It's like a filter. You know, you come through us, tell us your story, we'll tell it. You know, there's still plenty of that. People that don't want to bother to start a website or don't have time to promote themselves.
Sure.
Oh, talk to me about a record. That's, you know, that's great.
Yeah.
For sure. And tag to that is that's the best promotion an artist can have, is when a reliable source, you know, interviews like this, you know, podcasts, you know, when someone's putting out a movie or an album and you see them all over TV and radio and, you know, online, it's like, that's kind of, if you have any kind of authority in the space, that's the best promotion, more than advertising and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, so I think there will always be value to that. You know, there's like you said, Ryan, like players go, and Chris, you know, people go on every day. And they have their face on their camera and they'll tell their story and they'll, you know, kind of talk to things. But when it's through another lens, you know, or a writer, then it, you know, it's definitely takes a different form.
Yeah. So, yeah. What got you, John, interested in journalism initially?
Well, it was funny because I was in a band, and this was back in like 2004 when it was like you were either a local band or you were signed. And before,
where was this at? Was this Arizona?
Arizona, yeah.
Okay.
And I was in a band that was on the verge of getting signed, and we disbanded when our singer moved. And so I started studying upright bass. I was like, all right, I'm just going to be a bass player now. So I started studying upright bass with Ed Friedland, who's amazing. Yeah. And
he was teaching at U of A for a while, right?
Yeah. And he's all over. He's in the Mavericks now. He was a bass player, writer forever. He's been on with us. You know, we're going
to. That's how I got hip to him, is I think reading his articles back in the day in bass player.
One of the best people and funniest on earth.
Nice.
And he and one day we were hanging out after a lesson, and he's like, Johnny, what do you want to do, you know, now that your band is dissolved? And I was like, I'd love to do what you do. And you know, write about bass. And he goes, oh, he's like, all right. He's like, find a bass player to interview and interview them, write something up, and I'll give you points and, you know, edit it and critique it. And I said, great. And so I got a hold of a band I liked at the time, Circa Survive out of Philadelphia, their bass player, Nick Beard, and did an interview and wrote it up in the style of all the bass players I'd been reading, and gave it to him. And then like the next day he was like, this is actually pretty good. And at the time he was with Elton Bradman, who was the editor in chief of Guitar World's Bass Guitar magazine. Chris was obviously with, you know, bass player at the time.
Yeah.
And he gave it to Elton. And I got a call a week later and Elton's like, I need young blood. You know, I was like 24 at the time. And he's like, why don't you start writing? I was like, sure. And so, all of a sudden he, you know, sent a bunch of interviews my way, and I just kind of started and was so into it. And I was still in school at the time, And I just picked up more. I was kind of the guy that if there was a last second story, like I would take on everything and fake it till I make it, you know, can you do this? Oh yeah. And then I would I do not know how to do this. And then I became his web editor back in like 2005. And then he asked me to come out to New York and be his managing editor. And then right as kind of that was going on, the magazine got bought by Future, which is a big parent company, and got dissolved. And so that was kind of that. And then in 2011, Elton went back to Bass Player and he called and said, come to Bass Player with me, you know, and brought me on there. So then I was able to link up with Chris and the whole team. So
cool, man. That's cool. Yeah. Who was the interview when you were starting out in the early days where you're just like, holy crap, I'm in the room with this guy?
Yeah, I mean, I remember my first three were Josh Warner, who was playing with Matis Yahoo, Blasco of Rob Zombie, and a hero of mine, Preston Crump, who recorded every podcast song. But then, you know, I would start getting into...
His name has come up a few times on the podcast. He's kind of a sleeper, like only kind of cats in the know about Preston. And he's crushing it.
I found out about him from liner notes and then like found him on MySpace. You know, he lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and just hit him up. And then we've been friends since. And cool. I mean, that guy's just done... He sculpted my teenage years. Then when I started getting up to like the... Mark Hoppus, you know, was kind of a one. And then I got to talk to Marcus Miller and I was like, oh, now I'm getting, you know, kind of deeper and deeper. And, you know, I had a big bucket list of players and luckily that's all checked off now. I mean, yeah, Chris, your bucket list must be entirely.
Yeah. Chris, which one, what was it for you? Like the first time you're sitting in the room, and I know that you just talked to Ron Carter, which I also want to talk to you about, Chris.
Oh yeah.
But like when you were first starting out in journalism and the whole base, you know, media world, who are one of the first where you're like, holy crap, holy crap.
Oh my God. I mean, I've always been different because I liked the session guys as a kid and wanted to be that. So I didn't get to do a lot of the rock stars. So I don't have the stories like John and Herrera where they got drunk with a rock star.
Yeah. I think I'm more on your side of the fence in this, Chris. Like the session guys are what excite me.
Go to Electric Lady and talk to this guy.
Yeah.
I think the departure, it wasn't Bass Player yet, but what was it when N-Twistle, when there was the Who tour?
Oh, and yeah. We were just talking about this.
The band wasn't doing interviews, but he wanted to talk to us. So his people snuck me into the hotel. he wasn't allowed to tell the band he wanted to do this interview. That was pretty amazing being around a rock star because I've been used to the session because I knew those guys.
The Will Lees and the
Will Lees. Yeah. That was a cool early one because we did this huge cover story and then Letterman held it up on the show.
Oh, cool.
Cover Bass Player.
Crazy.
Look, Will's on the cover, and he sarcastically said to Paul, "Paul, remind me, I think my subscription ran out."
Yeah.
Get you, Letterman. Yeah. No, that's amazing. Yeah.
That's cool, man.
Early stuff, something good. Going to Milt Hinton's house with Daryl Jones.
Oh my gosh.
Chris's stories are insane. Like, and I feel like I still, even after working with Chris for like 12, 13 years now, only know like a third of them. Every time I bring up someone, he's like, oh, that's like when I was eating dinner at their house. And I'm like, what? You know, like,
have you ever thought about writing a book, Chris, about like kind of chronicling, not just, I mean, the interviews you've done are already released in the world, but the backstory behind some of these interviews.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's not like the rock star thing. It's like, it's not really juicy stuff.
Bass nerds like me would be into that though, because want to connect with these guys like John Edwards, that you can't connect with anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I should. I haven't thought about it, but like what's happening now is Elton decided to put together a story with all the people from Bass Player now that Bass Player is gone.
Mm-hmm. All the editors and all the writers.
Massive piece, so it's good you're asking because I'm literally looking at the article I wrote for him, which has my high points and stuff.
Oh, nice.
So we're thinking about all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, really, I'm looking at my list and, you know, Anthony and stuff, but I have to say number one was going into the Motown vault
with
Anthony and James Jamerson Jr. and hearing Jamerson unfettered or with a few mm-hmm. other different instruments. That's one that stands out.
And yeah. that was big because of the Carole Kay, you know, Jamerson thing. And you were like holding the tapes, you know, that these recordings were on. And like,
should we talk about that? Can we go there? Or should I edit this out? I kind of want to hear your thoughts. I can edit this out.
It keeps coming up because bass player just ran something that was kind of counter to what was discovered. And they were like, oh, it's settled. It was Carole Kay on everything. And like, I mean, man, like.
Well, this is... was Joel was looking for a piece on it. And some teacher in Texas had done a paper on the controversy.
Okay.
Right? So Joel, I mean, we love Joel, but we.
Joel McIver, who was the last editor of the British bass player.
Okay. So. Okay.
We chastised him because he was probably overwhelmed, but he didn't have time to really check. Like, he didn't check where that was.
Yeah.
The source. And so he ran with this. And then he quickly apologized and talked to Slutsky, and Slutsky explained it. But really, of all the things you've heard and all the comparable tracks, the final proof is what Alan calls forensic evidence, which is there was a glitch in the Motown machine that made a sound, so you could now definitely hear. It's James.
Wow, that's some bass so now, player CSI.
It's bass player CSI. Yeah,
it is. It's good to bed now. That really explains it. I don't blame Carol. I understand she saw her name on contracts, but.
I don't. Yeah. I'm not blaming anybody. She's a legend in her own right. And
right.
I do think. When I was curating like transcriptions to do of Jamerson, and mostly just for my own whatever thing, before I started this, I used to just analyze Jamerson's playing, and there's a couple really secret signature things that would show up in his playing towards the later half of the 60s. And what one of them was in measure 2 is where he would kind of play an idea. It was always in measure 2 that idea would become what he used the next time that section of the song happened again.
Interesting.
And it always happened. And there was like this little kind of cryptic signature.
Wow.
And then I was doing a podcast interview with a drummer named Herman Matthews. When I started this thing, I was just calling up homies like, dude, you know, I'm like, I don't know. And, you know, and so Herman, Isley Brothers, you know, Tower Power before Garibaldi, like he knows the music.
I want to interject and say Herman, in the Rocco cover I did after the first Rocco, the next big Rocco cover, he had the pull quote of all times, which is Herman said, without Rocco, T.O.P. would be just another horn band.
Me and Herman were sitting at a restaurant just kind of catching up before we did the interview. And I remember talking to him about the Jamerson KLK thing. And I'll never forget it. He just kind of looks up. He's like, just listen to it. Done. I'm like, yeah, that's it. Yep. That's it. Right. Like, sure. It's funny to hear that little tidbit about the machine, though, because I never had heard that.
Well, that's the latest.
I
learned that. But yeah, I mean, it was for a long time. People would play the I Was Made to Love Her against the Beach Boys' I Was Made to Love Her because they claimed that was Carole, and you could really hear how different their styles were. Turns out that's not Carole. That was, what's our guy's name? Good bass. I can't think of his name. Another Motown alternate that was in L.A. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, but someone like you investigating like that and coming up with that, that's gold. I mean, that's something you do on your own without knowing anything in the context.
Yeah, that was just me digging around. And I mean, like, I remember Bernadette was up for grabs and like Carole was saying that was her. And like, no, that's not.
Yep.
No.
And yeah. And you know, and in Carole's defense and everyone's defense, like one thing we always learn about is that these hubs for sessions like Motown and all that, like even the modern ones, like when you talk about Questlove and James Poizier and the Soul Quarians and all that, is a lot of these session players, like we talked to, again, like Ben Kenny, Adam Blackstone, all these cats, where you'll go into a studio for a weekend and you'll cut so many takes of just playing over stuff. And then they would always say, you would hear it on the Erykah Badu album and you would hear it on the D'Angelo album and you would hear this riff I played, you know, on the new Tribe Called Quest. And so many times in the studio, you're just cutting so much stuff. And it's, you know, so I could see where there would be you know, confusion or false, you know,
and the organization of the record industry when you're talking about, you know, the 60s, you know, and especially add that layer of Berry Gordy to that, you know, so like, who knows? But I think Herman was onto something. He said, man, just listen to it. I'm like, yeah, like that's, if you just A/B the sound and approach and like all that stuff, the feel, like, yeah, that's,
he was that's a triplet that. Swing guy. And that's what people miss. No, a lot of other guys didn't have that. Jameson had that swing in everything. Damn.
Man, I remember reading some forum on Talkbase once where someone proposed the question, like, besides Rocco and Pastorius, you know, who else for the 16th note funk thing? And I'm like, man, Jameson. Like, are you kidding me? Come on. Yep. And he was only using one finger.
It's like, insane, because some footage is now emerging that we always run online. Yeah. And you see that hook and you see it. It's just literally just, it's insane. The you know, capacity that he has.
Yeah, with that dexterity.
Oh, my gosh. And
it played as a track in the vault. I forgot what was the name of it. It was an unreleased track. But Harry Wenger, the producer, said, oh, we got this track. And he's playing 16th through it with one finger.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And getting all the muting and stuff. And like, I forgot when I was doing my Jameson deep dive. His first sessions were on upright, and I forgot the name of the tune.
That's right, yeah.
But he was an upright guy first. And his first sessions were for a female-owned record label.
Mm.
And it was like, I remember thinking it was like, just to be in that room, how progressive that was at that time to have a female-owned record label. And then you're sitting here with like the dude, you know, in my opinion, the best bass player of all time.
Oh yeah!
Like, oh my gosh! Like, what would that energy be like? Like two just visionaries, in their own right. Like, that's amazing.
Absolutely.
Had you heard the story? Chuck must have told you the story about bringing him to MI Musician Institute at the time. You know,
Chuck Rainey.
Rainey brings Jameson in.
Okay.
To do a clinic on electric bass, and Jameson, forget the electric bass, play the real instrument, the upright. And it's like, wow, here's the greatest electric bass player ever saying no.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's crazy. I always forget that he started on upright.
All the years, of all the Jameson guys I've heard that can do it well, man, his son had just, it was another level of like that. He sounded like his dad and sounded like nobody else.
Just DNA. That bass player live where we gave Jameson, you know, the award, we had Pino, we had his son, we had Phil Chen, we had an amazing panel. And that was cool because they were all playing their favorite Jameson bass lines, and they were like songs I had never heard in my life. Like, I remember Pino's like, this is my favorite Jameson group. And he just starts playing the illest bass line you've ever heard.
Yeah.
And everyone in the room was like, what song is this? You know? Like,
yeah. Man, Pino, what Pino has done with just the neo soul aspect of his career, let alone like all the pop rock stuff, like touring with Nine Inch Nails, you know, like The Who, like being as transitionary as he is, but just the neo soul thing, like someone who embodies the spirit and like just developed that neo soul style single-handedly was I mean, just that aspect of his career. Like then you got all the fretless stuff and that dude is ridiculous.
Pino is the
Pino's
the in my opinion, and from doing, you know, 400 interviews I have, he is the flawless one, to where he's just every bass player infallible. And you know, it's hard because, you know, you have your heroes and icons and you're like, oh, they're amazing. And someone's like, yeah, but like this or this, you know. And Pino's just always the utmost respect from every bass player on the planet, you know,
yeah.
Like that guy.
Yeah, well, I think
it's the other night with at the Blue Note with Robert Glasper.
That's right. You went there. Yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, at the end, he was saying to me, I can't believe these guys let me play with them. I'm like, no,
yeah, it's the other way around.
Right. Everybody else is thinking like, Pino, I can't believe you took the gig.
Yeah.
do. But Michelle came and broke out her bass. And
Michelle.
It was pretty crazy.
That's cool. Was it just a huge bass hang because Pino was on it?
You know, Patitucci was there, and the other guy that's
Vicente Archer.
Was he that? And I saw.
No, I know who it is. He's a beast.
the Houston Ernest Travis. So Travis Burness.
Ernest Travis. Yeah.
He plays on the common stuff. I saw him.
Okay.
He was going out of his mind. He's still texting me the next day. I can't believe what we heard last night. Blown away. Yep. Yeah. That's a whole, when you look at the schools of music as I do, because I'm more a historian, I think now at this point, I'm just starting to realize, wait a minute, that was the last major movement in music. That's right. Remember that D'Angelo thing was
what the neo soul.
Man, I talk about that a lot. And like that, so when did that come out? That came out in 98, 99?
Yeah, it was the mid to late 90s, Voodoo. And it was the Soul Quarians, which was Pino, James Poyser, Questlove, D'Angelo, yeah. Q-Tip, J Dilla. And they just kind of changed the face.
They made three records at once.
They had Electric Lady and they were making the new D'Angelo. They were doing the Roots. They were doing Erykah Badu. They were doing Common and Mos Def.
Yeah, yeah.
And they would just go from room to room. And it just, that wave just changed
everything.
And I love that because Pino, you know, changed his whole, you know, in the 80s, Pino was a huge icon for what he was doing, Fretless Music Man and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden he goes flats and a P bass. And changes it again, you know, and it's like crazy.
It's because of an interview in Bass Player Magazine with him about that article where he's talking about like hanging out with Quest and they're just, or maybe it was an interview with Quest in Modern Drama.
That was yours. I think I remember this.
I remember going to interview him and his whole thing had changed. He started playing with his thumb.
Yeah.
And we transcribed some of that Voodoo in that interview. I have to go back and read it because all that's sticking in my mind now is, when he heard the laid-back stuff, he associated with African music he'd heard.
Right.
He took to it. But that doesn't mean, you know, I think at that point he came to it like all of us, like, wow, what's this? Like, yeah. My favorite story from that is he said, not everybody got it. At one point, Lenny, what's his name, Kravitz, came through the studio to listen. And while other people were blown away, Kravitz was like, what's with the weird behind the beat thing?
Right. Yep. Yep. For sure. So,
it's all how it is. And somehow Pino took to what they were trying to do. And
that all stemmed from the producer who's one of my heroes, Jay Dilla, who started the broken beat with the kick. Like his big thing is he would not have a repetitive kick pattern. And he was kind of like rewrote the book on drums that influenced every drummer and even bass players. Still, I'll do an interview with a metal bass player. And they're like, oh, well, if I want to get the Dilla bass sound, I can do this, you know, like it's crazy, but that little pocket of musicians just changed everything in the late 90s for everyone.
Gotta explain it to me because I understand as a kid, like Stevie was such a great keyboard bass player that bass players emulated him. But this moment where maybe it's Questlove, they decide that, wow, I want to sound like a machine. That's transformative.
Right.
Like, wow.
He was
so blown away by what Dilla did that he wanted to sound like that.
That was all that Jay Dilla cat, you know. When I did my long interview with Colin Greenwood from Radiohead, he spent like 30 minutes talking about Jay Dilla and that neo soul movement and how much it influences Radiohead. It was just that pocket, Chris, like you were saying, at Electric Lady, that those musicians that just, man,
right? That's why they hired Pino for that tour, right, with the Nine Inch Nails, was that same thing. Tell us about the D'Angelo record.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, I mean, I read that article, and then, like, when I got to L.A., I was doing sessions for the dude who engineered Chronic and Shady Record, so I was doing a bunch of hip-hop records, and so as soon as I got the call, the first thing was, like, go to the guitar store, get flats, try to get that Pino thing.
Flats on the P-bass. Yeah. And that's what's crazy about social media and the internet now is bass trends are so much more rapid now.
Yeah,
because back then you would go, you know, like in the 90s, everyone had SWR rigs and like Warwick basses for the Peanut, Lance kind of Norwood Fisher thing. And then, you know, it would take a while to catch on. And then it was like Pino flats and P bass. But now it's instantaneous to where all of a sudden short scale basses, boom, all of a sudden one day everyone has a short scale. And then all of a sudden it's like everyone's playing the Noble DI and boom. Noble DI as a standard, you know, and so that's one interesting element of.
Are you seeing that burn out quickly though? Like you're talking about how everybody's getting on board quick, but do you see them jump ship quick also? Like
something, yeah, some things stick around, and you have cats that are kind of the gold standard, like Tim LaFave, you know, yeah. If that guy plays something on his socials, the bass world's going to play the next day, you know? Sure. And so, but I think you're right, Ryan, that like those will fizzle, you know, kind of quickly. You'll see some things that are hot, you know, and everyone gets it. And then 2 months later, everyone's like, no, but this thing now, you know? Right. And so, but the really, you know, there are pieces of gear that are just always going to be relevant, you know, and yeah. necessary and that everyone has. So,
Chris, I asked John earlier what his rig was. What are you playing? What's your personal rig? Like your go-to personal rig?
Oh, my God. So first I have to say that I've never been the gear guy in all the 40 mm-hmm. years.
Okay. Now, again, I'm kind of like that. I'm not a huge yeah. gear guy. I have what works and then I'm done.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I've not tried all the stuff. It just so happened that when bass player started, Harkey started, I went and did the factory tour, got friendly with Larry. They got me the rig right away, and I'm still a Harkey.
Okay.
Yep.
They okay. got a great 800-watt head that's really light, and the new high drive got just always, I'm not endorsing them. I just can't.
Yeah, that's just what you're doing.
Right.
Yeah. What I've been playing. And when you're playing weddings in New York and all the different rooms, you really need that non-colored tone. You know, you've got to really be flexible.
Yeah, I mean, is it cool to transport? Is it? Are they heavy? I mean, that's my thing. Like, I have an Epiphone Ultralight because I don't want to carry stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
The high drive stuff is supposedly lighter. We just have it on our truck. But yeah, I think if I was not in that situation and I was looking to buy gear now, I think that's the fascinating new movement. Ooh, light gear that really can stamp and handle a low B string. So
Yeah. Yeah, and like they're so small now. I mean, like you know, it's like acoustic image like is crushing the game and has been for years. Phil Jones is doing all kinds of things with just little lunchbox amps that are 800 watts. Yeah,
how small can it get before it literally can't physically handle it?
I know exactly.
Yeah, Phil Jones told us in this column he wrote for us on amplification. That sticks with me is the ideal, if you could have the ideal setup as the bass player and when you go to any venue or club, if you could get them to set you up in the corner, because that's how bass best goes right. out.
Yeah.
Yep.
Be the ideal setup, not in the middle of the room, not in the...
Yep.
Right.
Somehow be the guy that's in the corner, your frequency.
Yep. Goes. For yeah, sure.
I remember talking to him at NAMM a few years ago. He's fascinating. He's so into the physics of it all.
Oh,
he's really fascinating to talk to.
Mad scientist. It's, you know, I always kind of secretly appreciate because, you know, when we do all of our interviews, we get the gear list. And nowadays, when you hit to amps and pedals, it can be a long list. And we have to Google the hell out of stuff. They'll be like, oh, like I have like the Black Cat Midnight, like Series 2 Dissolver. And I'm what? You know, and but I secretly always love bass players where I'm like, all right, tell me about, you know, your rig. And they're like, oh, I have a 71P bass and an SVT. And I'm like, okay. And what about pedals? And they're like, no pedals. And I'm like, okay. And what strings? And they're like, oh, I haven't changed those in years. You know, I love that old school, just kind of bass into amp.
Yeah,
you know, there's so like even like we just ran something on Poslin Chanton on the new Pixies album and just Ampeg and her 65 P bass, you know, and
yeah,
and but then it is, you know, you do get into to players who just the gear. I'm like, will you write that out and copy and paste it to me?
Right.
Like,
these
800 pedals on your, you know, pedal board.
Right.
But there's places for all that, you know,
there is. And I mean, you know, that's part of their sound. I think people that do that, that are heavy in the effects game, that have a processed sound, like that's part of their artistry and what they're doing with the instrument. And I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen it a lot. Is it with the magazine, the more technology advances and how that shapes bass players, what they're releasing bass players and how it's changing playing styles.
Exactly. Because
I mean, when there is just basses, well, then we're just playing the bass. Now that there's all this stuff, well, then there's going to be guys that play all the stuff.
Of course, like Chris, even in the early days of bass players, like Bass Player Magazine, would there even be a pedal section for the gear list? Like, or was it just like Chromatic Tuner?
Yeah.
People were into pedals already by the 90s, so you'd always have somebody. Back then, it was almost the heyday of, if you guys think of the 90s, it was so in a lot of ways really gear heavy with bass. And that was the days of you brought the rack of
Oh, man, I forgot about the processor
and the preamp.
Yeah,
and
everybody would show up with like a 115 and like a four rack space SKB. Yes. Yeah,
yeah, that's crazy.
He went to LA to do the Don Henley record, which he got by accident, and showed up and they went, "Where's your rack?" He said, "I don't have a rack. I have OC2. That's all I need."
Yeah. The OC2 is
who is this?
Dina.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He had heard that there was something like he had heard that Don Henley was looking for him, but Henley wasn't. So he called Henley and Henley said, "Well, no, I wasn't looking for you, but since you called, come by, you know."
Yeah. Yes.
Just by accident.
Dude, those stories. That's got to go in your book, Chris.
Yeah, see, there could be
those stories.
That I could look at these stories and think of the backstories in my head, but would anybody care? I mean, I think it's so.
I mean, I think the important thing that we can still carry is kind of the players who have passed. You know, that's kind of another thing, Ryan, with Bass Magazine right now is we're saying let's get to these players who you know, might not be here much longer, so that we're writing about them and interviewing them now where it's not an obituary, because that's happened to us a lot.
Right.
You know, and I remember I had a streak where like I talked to Chi Chang of Deftones a couple weeks before his accident.
Oh wow.
I talked to Jack Bruce a month before he passed.
Oh, wow.
I did a big interview, and then we hung out with Lemmy Kilmister a week before he died. Within the month that he died.
Okay.
And so you kind of look back on that and you remember conversations you had and you're like, everyone should know that, you know, everyone, you know, and so it's so devastating when you lose, you know, it's kind of like a piece of bass history.
Absolutely.
You know, kind of goes with them. And so, you know, that's why with people like Chris and Jim Roberts, who was also one of the early bass player, editors, the first, you know, editor, you know, even Elton Bradman, Ed Friedland, all these guys, Carl Coryat, like they have these stories that are just paramount to bass history.
Yeah.
And so that's also why we always do what we do and kind of look back and.
Oh, I want to assuage my guilt. A reader hooked me up with a really undersung early R&B pioneer named Bernard Reed. And I wish I could think of the tracks, but you'd be blown away how cool. And
Bernard Reed, I'm
going to him and I didn't get the interview in time. It's always you have six stories you're writing. Oh yeah, I'll get to it. And then he passed away, and I'm like, oh
yeah,
oh
yeah.
No.
Sorry, I didn't get to tell your story because it blew me away how far
ahead my forever regret story was I was working with a publicity team who covered all these amazing artists, and one of them was Beastie Boys, and Beastie Boys was inactive because Adam Yauch had cancer at the time. And I approached him. This is when I was just a contributor to Bass Player, like no one even, you know, on the staff. Chris probably didn't even know who I was. And I talked to him and I said, could I interview Adam? You know, like I haven't really seen a lot of proper bass articles. And they're like, let me feel it out, you know. And then they got back to me and they're like, Adam's interested. He's actually living on Sheryl Crow's ranch with her. And they're playing a lot of bass together right now. And I was like, holy shit, that's a story. So I kept emailing it to the current editor at Bass Player at the time. And emailing, let me do this interview. And back in this time, you would have to have the editor sign off if you were a freelancer that I am part of this magazine. I'm not just a fan kind of getting to this artist.
Right.
And just that editor never got back to me on it. And like a month later, Adam Yauch died. And I was just like, oh, like, you know, I wish I could have, because I know he was in like a cool headspace where he was accepting his fate and just playing bass with Sheryl Crow.
Right, right.
That's the story that got away from me that I'm always still just like, damn, like I wish I could have landed that.
I mentioned this earlier, then we can wrap up. But Chris, you just talked to Ron Carter, the maestro Ron Carter, about his documentary.
Tremendous documentary made by a great filmmaker.
Yes.
Okay.
So not like, you know, just another music documentary with your friends. This guy did the documentary up to Peter. My brain is dead. He made the documentary on Obama on Air Force One, like a really first-rate PBS documentary.
Okay.
So that was another freaking wedding connection. I'm playing this with this event in Chicago for some big computer company doing our dance stuff. And the guy comes up at the end, oh, the band sounds great. I'm so-and-so. And he was a partner of Peter's, and they were going to do this documentary. So quickly, I helped him get a few people through Ron. But they didn't even need my input. They got all the inner core for Ron and the picture and the movie, and it's just great. And then I got to interview him with it, which is always terrifying because Ron is a scary.
Are you in the documentary interviewing, or was this for the magazine that you interviewed?
This was just we did the first story about it, which John posted the day before it aired.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. They all really liked it. Maestro liked it. We call him the Maestro. But I mean, that's I don't know what else to say except every time I have to talk to him, I'm terrified, and it's somehow okay. But he's 85. He doesn't have time to waste. You know, at this point, he's very much. You know, I got to do my thing. I said, you want me to send you the piece to look over? No, I take my chance. I'll take my chance. I did of him and John playing through the standard. You know, he has different plays different chord changes. No, I take my chance. So he. And he's 85. He's just wants to do what he has to do.
Yeah, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Were either of you at his birthday at Carnegie?
Yeah, I went to that too. I took Anthony.
Okay.
Anthony Jackson, yeah.
And we got backstage, so there's like photos of Anthony and Stanley and Ron. I was very proud of that. And
yeah, a friend of mine, Marlon, was out there hanging with Stanley.
So he saw that show?
Yeah.
Great concert. I mean, Ron is... I think Stanley puts it best. He's the greatest constructor of bass lines. You know, he's the guy.
Yeah.
Oh, man. He's the dude. I mean, just with the record for recordings and just you look at his body of work. And that was a cool thing in your interview. That interview is fantastic. And it covers a lot of his life and career. But the path that he took, because he was into orchestra.
Did you guys read his book? Like, I read his book as soon as it came out. And that's
right.
That's something I didn't know about him, that he was a classical player first and like was that dedicated to it. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, he sings them. I mean, so me ask him, would you have done jazz at all? No, I would have been a classical guy.
Yeah.
Why? Right. And it was kind of a matter of almost like segregation of why.
Very much so.
He ended up with jazz. And that's a testament to him to not even be able to do the thing that you're naturally amazing at and passionate about, pivoting. And then just becoming the master of that world, you know, like that's just astounding.
Yeah. I mean, I really think that he was going to be a master at wherever he landed, you know, and it's by unfortunate circumstances, he ended up playing jazz as a jazz musician. I'm so thankful that he exists in jazz history and, you know, he's a living legend, but he would have been great at wherever he landed, like he was going to excel at, because I don't know if he's capable of anything else. I think he's just has that not achiever mentality, but his level of precision and connection and all those things, like he was going to be great at whatever it was.
That's what Anthony has, that's what Michael Brecker had. Yeah, those guys have a level of commitment that you think you're dedicated, but you're not at that. Those guys,
I know, like it just makes you feel bad, doesn't it? It makes me feel bad, like, oh man, I gotta get my shit together.
Yeah, because the highest level players are just, they work harder than you still.
Right.
And that's what's even like with the Jocko doc, you know, and all this stuff with all that and interviews, that's a cool thing nowadays, these documentaries and thoroughly researched books and pieces coming out, as you learn so much. But yeah, someone like Jocko, you learn about his, you know, work ethic and how much he put into his playing. And, you know, just like Carter, you realize, and it's good for young players, that just the greats are the greats because they did the work, and they always did the work, you know.
I tell you where they got humbled. There's a new Darryl Jones doc, and it's great because he explains the point where he was, you know, he was a jazz fusion wannabe, and then he got a few vital lessons in Chicago about, you know, you got to be a groove guy. But what I would say about Ron briefly, the big takeaway is this is the best role model for bass players of any age, because he's the guy that's like, F you, I'm the bass player. Here's where it is.
Yep.
I'm the trunk. I'm the tree trunk. If you could go in with that mentality, because it's not in a truck range.
Mentality. I completely agree with you. It's that mentality while staying out of drugs and still conducting himself with a high level of professionalism all the time and demanding that from the people that are around him.
All of those things. That turns people off. But in that movie, the touching stuff, like, years after he left Miles, going over with his son to visit and bring Miles food. It's like, wow, he's just
For sure. I mean, and he's a stickler. He or his people are very active on social media, and he posts some of the best things bass players can read. And about a year ago, he posted like Ron Carter's unwritten rules for gigs. And they were so strict. One of them was like, you may not have any drinks on stage, even water. Like, do not take a sip of any fluids while you perform. Like, your socks have to match your pants. You know, if you're 45 minutes early, or, you know, if you're 30 minutes early, you're late, you know, like, and it was these like old school things that I was reading. And I was just like, man, that's a tall order to uphold. And then you realize like, that's how this dude became this dude, is like, you know, setting those standards. And like you said, holding everyone else to them too.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's crazy.
The Ron piece that I split with another writer back in the Baseway days, they sent me to his apartment to watch him give a lesson to what happened to be Dwayne Berno, who's like a mainstream New York, very advanced.
Yep.
The whole lesson was the B flat scale. The whole lesson.
Right.
Hey, the B flat. Dwayne, you got to be able to wake up at 2 a.m. in the dark, walk over to your bass and find that B flat. I mean,
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, all of that, like that level of consistency with how he conducts himself, like that level of that all transmits to his playing, you know?
Oh, yeah. And his just students.
Focus.
Everyone who studied under him that I've interviewed talks about, you know, Brandy Disterheff, who's an amazing New York upright player who's in the documentary. Mm-hmm. You know, she would talk about, Ron would have her put like maybe coins or something in between her both hands, and so that to keep the spacing, like while she plays.
Yeah.
She said her hands still get sore, you know, like thinking about her lessons with him and just how and that's the old school way, you know. That's not that's not fast YouTube licks or Instagram reels. That's like, you're gonna do this for, you're gonna play, you know, this line for 4 hours straight until you hit it perfectly, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming, I've never done this, but I'm assuming it would be like, you know, studying with a Tibetan monk or something and immersing yourself in that thing, and you got to shave your head, you're not talking for 30 days, and then, you know, like some really strict kind of hazing situation, but it's going to change you, and that's the point.
Yes.
You know, so if you're focused on the value, then... Ron has been great. Ron's everything I've read about him is amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. I'd love to take a lesson with him.
Oh, yeah.
That would be the best.
And I will say, you still have your chance, you know.
Now, I know.
Kind of like we talked about, you know, in our last chat, that was the one cool thing about COVID was everyone was taking lessons with everyone because everyone was accessible, you know.
Right.
So it's still kind of a golden era of players studying with other players who are either peers or unlikely teachers, you know.
Yeah, and people being able to get press that they maybe wouldn't have otherwise.
For sure.
You know, and get their thing out there, because everybody does have something to say.
Yes, right.
Most of the time.
Yeah. That's what keeps Chris and I doing what we're able to do, and you doing what you're able to do, is people want to talk and people want to listen. So
yeah, absolutely. Fellas, this has been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to have you guys back on when you guys can make the time.
Oh, we would love to, man. Such a pleasure, man.
Real quick, what's coming up on the next issue of Base Magazine that everybody can look out for?
Yeah, the next issue's coming out this month. Now that it's, I can't believe it's November already. Every month is like that. But you're looking at, we have the amazing Laura Lee of Krungbin on our cover, who is just amazing. I love her playing, and she's becoming such an ambassador of the bass. It also features Robert DeLeo talking about his new solo album. Lincoln Goins, who Chris was talking about earlier, Dane Alderson.
People have to check out The Art of the Bass Choir by Lincoln.
Man, I've been meaning to reach out to him. I want to talk to him about that.
Great.
Absolutely should, man. Yeah. It's such a great album. We have John Campbell of Lamb of God. We have Jenny Lee Lindberg of War Paint. Emma Enzai, who's with Evanescence and doing the splitting time with her band Sick Puppies. We have Tanya O'Callaghan. Looks like we're gonna have Mike Dirnt of Green Day along with Nicole Rowe, and then a bunch of great gear reviews and lessons. And
Nicole's a sweetheart.
Awesome. Yeah, she's great.
We did an interview like a couple years ago, I think, and then I had a hard drive crash and I lost it, and then COVID happened, and we were just, you know, we kind of been, now she's back on tour, so tracking her down again is difficult, but she's an absolute sweetheart.
Oh, so, yeah, she's great, and a monster player, and she's got that what I've been geeking out on is she had Fender made her like a 5-string short scale that she's been touring with Panic. And that B string is just so taut. I mean, she, you know, she'll put on videos, you know, and she'll join like Scary Pockets and different groups and play, but her tone is just astounding, man.
Yeah.
So she's a great talk always.
Killer.
I also talked to Dane Oldiston for the new Yellow Jacket.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Monster player. So you'll have that. And then, plenty of content, obviously, every day at bassmagazine.com, the latest gear and artist news and regular issues and a whole lot of new stuff coming.
The whole episodes come out quarterly now.
Yeah. Well, quarterly and we're toying with a more frequent issue, kind of distribution. So, yeah, we're looking at 6 a year.
Okay.
That we're hoping for, especially, you know, given a lot of circumstances of bass journalism right now, we want to provide the bass world with as much as we can. So
yeah, good for you, fellas. Thank you so much,
man. Thank you so much for having us.
All right. That was my talk with John DeOria and Chris Giese. Man, such an honor to talk to those guys. Those dudes have been such a vital part of shaping the world of bass and the publication. I love the phrase bass journalism that they both use. I've never actually thought about it that way. It's bass journalism. I just never thought about it that way. But through their work in bass journalism, they have helped shape the scene in a pretty heavy way. So it was an honor to connect with both of them. And again, stop by bassmagazine.com to check out more and the latest articles and information that they have up there. If you're enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. Stop by thebassshed.com/podcast to learn all the places it lives, you know, within the podcast world, all the places you can listen to it. And subscribe there as well. You can stop by Instagram at the_bass_shed. That's about all I got for this one, folks. I will catch you on the next one in a minute.